my question is, can that be used as an object of concentration, as a sort of a method for concentration, or it's more about the use of the sound of silence, I think. How?
It's used as a reference point. And also, if you stay with it, you know, it'll have, you'll be patient enough to sustain it, and then it's self-sustaining. So you don't get kind of absorbed, but you get empty. So you don't kind of absorb yourself into it, but you have this experience of emptiness. And that's very nice. Because then you see the suffering of becoming a person. It makes it very clear. And then as a reference point, you always, like now I notice it and I can talk to you, so it's not like a, like if I'm going to listen to somebody speaking or to music or something, then I have to concentrate on what they're saying or what the sounds are, but this is just like background, like space, so, it's a fits into the realm of the immeasurables. It doesn't have any boundary. And consciousness, emptiness, they all come together. So then you can integrate it into just work or, because I do a lot of traveling, I've developed it in airports, waiting in immigration lines, waiting for baggage to appear. wherever, in London Underground, and in Amravati, we have a lot of lawns that need mowing, so, and they have lawnmowers that make a lot of noise. So I listen to the sound of silence behind the sound of the lawnmower. Things like this, the way of, so you're not just, it becomes, a sign of emptiness and non-self in which you're not, you can access it all the time. Or when you do get caught up into emotional states or something, the more you trust it, then the more you kind of just stop getting overwhelmed and caught up or resistant to your own feelings. Or also, like when people are, I found it very helpful when people like are criticizing me or are angry with me. So then they're saying not very nice things, and then I go to the sound of silence, and then I hear what they're saying, and I'm also aware of my own habit, emotional tendencies to react. But I can hold it there, so not just get caught in just my own personal reactions to somebody's anger or somebody's criticisms. Works very well.
Lately, I've been watching how lost and then found I am. So I'll get lost in mental and emotional states, and then I'm curious about that moment where you become mindful and you go, oh, I've been lost, and you go back to the breath or whatever the point of meditation is. It's almost a function of memory. I don't know. It's that moment of, oh, I've just been lost. And so life, for me, is kind of an oscillation between being lost and then snapping out of it. Being lost and then snapping out of it. If you could add some insight into that.
Yeah, well, that's like that, the way you get caught up into your feelings or reactions to things, and then there's always that point where you're aware that you've lost it, and then that's a point of awakened point. So then what I advise you to do is don't make anything like, oh, I've lost it, oh, there I go again, but just determine to just go right back to the immediate present, like the sound of silence or the breath or whatever you use. So you don't, you're not making anything about, because if you think you shouldn't, you're always getting lost in your emotions and start disparaging yourself, then you're creating a problem, a personal problem around it. And which is of no use. And then, so just trust yourself when that point where you suddenly realize you've gotten lost, then go back to the present. I made it a determination. As soon as I have that suddenly realized, and I'm back into the present with the sound of silence or the breath. Because the egos are really, it's where we get ideas of how to practice, and then we grasp the ideas, and then when we, intellectually we might understand it, but we think we should be able to do it, and then we can't do it according to the way we would like to, and then we create an ego around it, a sense of self-worth and lack of ability, and then disparaging. So that's what I encourage people to do, just from that point where you're suddenly awakened, that's a point of awareness right then. That's, if you're going to do anything, say thank you very much.
We have a little study group, and we're talking about the place in the Sound of Silence, the book The Sound of Silence, where the example of suffering was the someone pulling out your fingernails. We got very stuck on that, and I can't remember your exact words, but what you basically said is it's not, your suffering is not being caused by the person pulling out the fingernails. Caused
by your own mind. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I'm still I'm back with the person pulling out the fingernails is involved anyway. Well, nothing that bad's ever happened to me, so I don't. but the idea is that we tend to blame people for our suffering, so. Or sometimes, we are being abused by somebody else, or somebody has it in for us and spreads rumors about us and things like this. So you and then you can think I'm suffering because of that person, or that's on a just emotional level. But when that physically, it also you can apply it to physical torture. But if you you begin to see the causes of suffering, and the, these things you can't, what comes from without, what impinges on you, and just the having a human body which experiences pain, and disease and whatnot, then this is natural dukkha. It's like what they call sapawa dukkha. It's just the dukkha of having been born in a form like this on this planet. But then that's the nature of this realm. But then the dukkha of the Noble Truth is the dukkha we create about not wanting it, or being, you know, hating the person torturing us, or so you begin to, if you notice, just in like when you're sitting in meditation and your body starts feeling pain and unpleasant sensations, there's the emotional reaction of wanting to get rid of it, wanting to get away from it, wanting to change posture, and then there's, but as you just stop doing that and observe the actual sensation of what we might call pain, that the real suffering is our not wanting it. That's the same. That's the suffering we can't stand. So, you know, like people with chronic pain, you know, I know people that have terrible pain all the time, and so this is and Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he's done a lot of work on this with mindfulness, being able to separate the actual sensation from the aversion and emotional reactions we have to physical, to our own physical pain. You begin to be able to separate, see that there's one that's just part of the karmic condition of this realm, then the other is what we create out of not wanting it and resenting it or hating. Or if somebody is, like I found somebody is, you know, spreading rumors about me that are not true, or about Amaravati that are not true, or things like this, and then I get a personal reaction of indignation, and I begin to see that as suffering. You know, so even if people are spreading rumors about me, I can use that too for practice. You know, I'm not asking the world, I'm not even asking for fairness anymore. I'll just take what I get, really. And then, I met when I was in Dharamsala one time, this was in the 90s, I think, they had a big meeting with the Dalai Lama about Western teachers, and I met somebody, I think it was American, who was working with refugees, Tibetan refugees that had fled out of Tibet, and he was telling me of this Tibetan nun who he was interviewing, and she was she'd been in prison for 18 years. And raped and treated badly by the guards, and she had her beads and her mantras, and then they took away her beads and they forbade her to chant the mantra, so she just kept chanting it inwardly. And so, you know, they couldn't stop her from doing that. And then he said she's one of the brightest people he's ever met, you know. So I didn't know this person, this nun, but I mean, it, I can see if you have faith and you have this inner strength, then we aren't creating suffering around what's happening to us physically, or, you know, even in personal humiliations or brutality, if we have that confidence and strength or faith, so it's, you know, this is where, before any of that happens to us, I suggest working with it just in ordinary life, just the, those are the real challenges. I decide, you know, like I don't expect to be, I'm going to be nailed to a cross or brutalized or anything, but in this lifetime, at least I hope not, but then the, you know, the real challenge has been with just the ordinariness of life, not, you know, the irritations, frustrations, disappointments, blame, and the things that happen to me in just ordinary ways, you know, nothing that dramatic or traumatic. And that's where you'll gain your confidence and strength. And then they recently they're making a series of films on religious architecture. I think it's some BBC or some television company, and they did one, the first one on Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And so they, it's quite interesting, they had, you know, like Jewish synagogues. They found one of the oldest synagogues is in Prague. And then one of the most modern architectural wonders of synagogues in New York City. And then they did one on Islam from in Woking in England, southern England. There's a mosque, one of the oldest mosque in the UK. And I didn't even know it existed. And then they photographed all these beautiful mosques in Iran and places like that. Then Christianity, of course, they had what's his name? The one that built a beautiful chapel in France. One of the Impressionist painters, French.
I think it was Monet who painted the cathedral. And
no, this was...
Christopher Wren. No, Corbusier?
No, no, is it painter?
Painter.
Rothko? Was contemporary with Picasso, what's his name? It'll come in a few minutes. Yeah, that is very beautiful. And then, you know, some of the beautiful basilicas in Europe. And then they had one modern, beautiful architectural wonder in Seattle, Roman Catholic Church. And so then the series is on Buddhism, Hinduism, and Taoism. So they filmed the Buddhist one. They started out with Amaravati town. So it was, and the one that came, you know, that's kind of the interviewer, the one that's presenting this is John McCarthy, who's a famous, he was a journalist in Beirut that was imprisoned for 6 years or so, and kept under in holes in the ground and tied up. And Brian Keenan was with him. He wrote a book called A Cruel Cradling or something. Very good. So John McCarthy was he was in this state of being terrorized for 6 years. And it got a lot of publicity in England, but talking to him was quite interesting because he had quite strong mystical experiences during that time. of being, just being incarcerated, bound and unknowing, uncertain. They never knew what was going to happen to them or where they would be next, and they're kept in dark holes and chained up and whatnot. So, I mean, it's a nightmare scenario, but talking to John McCarthy is quite interesting because he seemed like someone that was in himself quite at peace with himself now. He didn't seem like someone that had been, whose life had been ruined by that. So sometimes, these things force us into, either we go crazy and just lose it, or maybe we find that stillness within us, the center that isn't there, where we aren't creating suffering around the conditions that we have to experience and endure physically or mentally. So then, being brought up as a Christian, I must have this example of the crucifixion, and it's quite a strange thing. How could you, the forgiveness? Being humiliated and brutally, nailed to a cross, stripped naked, crown of thorns on your head, everything, your mother at the foot of the cross crying and people jeering, making fun of you. I mean, this is what we all, the ultimate in pain and humiliation. And then the sense of forgiveness. And then the kind of strange one I never quite understood of Jesus saying, "Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" So even at the last, even God deserts him. So he's just totally kind of humiliated. God's not going to come to the rescue. Not even keep him company while he's suffering. And then he surrenders, gives up to the moment. And to me, that's it, where you're not even asking God to come and save you, or you're not asking favors or expecting anything, but you just let go of everything. So that is, I don't know if Christians would agree with my interpretation, but that's a very extreme, kind of example. But in the Buddhas, the Buddha in the scriptures, in the suttas, was always, even after his enlightenment, he was challenged by people who tried to kill him and blamed for things he didn't do. And so we have one of these chants, the eight stanzas of victory, where the Buddha has to deal with various horrible situations. And of course it's always through mindfulness, through patience, through not through revenge or blame or asking for special favors from anybody. So this is, these are the messages you get for religious spiritual fulfillment is not for special favors or help from outside, but this whole sense of finding that within yourself. Whatever your karma presents you with. Yes.
I was wondering about humor in practice. A lot of meditation teachers are just very good-hearted laughter, humorous stories, I notice with myself that sometimes humor is a way for me to distract myself or change my emotions. And like I said, and in the suttas, sometimes, you know, you have a sense that the Buddha, you know, had a sense of humor, double entendres and things like that. So, you know, are there any sutras on humor, or is humor, you know, kind of a potential practice, or what's your experience?
Well, Ajahn Chah was very funny. But I mean, the thing is, it is humorous, you know, because the human ego is a totally absurd creation. So, you know, Ajahn Chah's, what I found very skillful with him was that he could get me to laugh at my own taking myself seriously and making my ego so, you know, the way I would tend to support my views and my egotistical tendencies. And he never scolded me or said I shouldn't do it, but he kind of joke about it, and then suddenly I could laugh at myself. Once they see that, you know, you're kind of, laughing at yourself, being able to laugh at your own mistakes or absurdity or pretensions is a helpful way of letting go. Because once you see it and can laugh at it, you can let it go. But if you're always defending your positions and your views and opinions and taking your ego seriously, then, you know, you're just always, you know, having to defend yourself or feel offended by when people laugh at you or whatnot. And so life just always creates more of reaffirms the ego as your reality. So Ajahn Chah, you know, he's a very charming person on a personal level. So people love to be around him. And he's very, you know, you just wanted to go near him and be in his presence, things like this, because he did have a kind of metta quality, and he was easily accessible, easy to talk to. He could be a lot of fun. And he had a lot of personal charm. So one time, one of the Western monks was saying, asking him, well, you have a, you know, you're a very charming person. You charm people. You kind of seduce us with your charm. so his response to that was, he says, it's my magnet. He says, that's what I draw people in. And then I can use it, they'll start, you know. I'd seen him, you know, just sit around with, like, people from the town and be very frivolous and jokey and unserious about everything. And think, what is he doing? You know, this is just chit-chat, senseless nonsense chit-chat, you know, get into this, you know, we want a serious Dhamma talks, not this stuff. And then I remember there was one Australian bhikkhu that was with us for one vasa, and he was dead serious about everything, and he is serious Abhidhamma practitioner, and so he was, you know, I invited him one evening to join us after the evening puja, Lungpo Cha's kuti, and he came. And Lungpo Cha that evening was just joking around, not saying anything profound. And this Australian monk got up and left, I can't be bothered with this, I'm going to go and study Abhidhamma. And it's And as soon as that monk left, suddenly the things turned. And I remember one of the most profound days in Aslan Puts I ever gave.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he just is like this, take, you know, so serious about the Australian, was so serious about himself. And a conceit of that, you know, I can't be bothered with nonsense. I'm a serious meditator. And if Ajahn Chah was really being mindful, he wouldn't talk like that and judgmental. And then he had his Abhidhamma tapes and things like this, that he was a real serious monk. He just wrote, by the way. But also, Ajahn Chah, I could see, would get people to relax. You know, like a lot of people coming from the town, merchants and whatnot, would oftentimes come for the wrong reasons. They want, like, lottery numbers, or there's a lot of superstition, you know, trying to get, you know, thinking Ajahn Chah is going to give them a medallion or something, and they come to get things and to, because they want, you know, success, make money and in their businesses. And Ajahn Chah he was very strict about not feeding these things like giving out numbers and whatnot, but he could entertain them and talk with them and chit-chat with them for hours. And then through that, over the years, I saw that a lot of these would seem like really, to me, you know, boring and unpleasant merchants, suddenly became very interested in Dhamma. You know, where when they came, they were interested in magic. But then through meeting Ajahn Chah, and he could get them to relax, he could befriend them, and they felt at ease with him, then they could ask questions, and it gets more into real Dhamma practice. So he had that ability, you know, to use his charm, not because he didn't need people. You know, he wasn't using it for himself. You know, personally, probably love to have gone off and not be bothered, but. Yeah, I saw him sit till 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning sometime with people, village people or town people that were upset and confused. And then he could, he used it as a way of getting people's confidence, relaxing them, and then they're more attentive to what he has to say when he does talk about Dhamma. He's not preaching at them anymore, just, you know, being so good that the a Chinese merchant just would be intimidated by such a saint. I mean, he could be, you know, quite, you know, tell jokes and chit-chat quite well with people. And he could use that as a way, not for, because he was heedless or distracted, but as a way of helping people to relax, gain confidence, and where then maybe the more, what they really need is more open to them, they're more willing to listen, more the situation arises where they actually might understand what he's talking about. I saw him exorcise a woman one time, an exorcism. It was incredible. There's a woman, maybe village woman, maybe about 40 years old. She'd gone completely crazy, screaming, yelling, and villagers didn't know what to do. They brought her into the monastery. And then it took about 4 or 5 men to hold her, you know. She's just wild and all over the place. And so they, and I was there with Ajahn Chah at his kuti, and bring this crazy woman in, and so Lungpacha's sitting there and he's smiling at her and she's screaming and yelling and about all these monsters eating her and torturing her, and then instead of trying to calm her down, he says things. Now they're eating your liver, and now they're and she's screaming, and then he says these things. And he's smiling all the time while he's doing this. And he's, now they're, you know, crawling up your intestines, eating your guts, and she'd scream louder and louder, and he said, scream louder, louder. And he got her, screamed for about half an hour, got her to totally in a state of absolute terror and screaming. And every time she kind of was getting tired and the screaming became less, he said, no, no, you've got to... And then after a while, it all stopped. She was totally exhausted. There were no more monsters in her. And so she was actually calm and sitting there. And then he gave her the five precepts. And he said, these will protect you from those monsters. And I...
you can come forward.
Questions? Or I have exercised all the questions. Forgiveness. Well, I mean, like, first of all, we think we should be able to forgive, don't we? And, you know, in this society, usually, forgive your enemies. And so it's an ideal of what we should be able to do. So I'm making a point of, you know, as a concept and as a cultural conditioning, you know, or if you're brought up in the Christian religion or whatever, you should forgive. And that's an intellectual ideal. But then the realities are around the emotional states we have. So it's... you know, like in metta practice, for example, we tend to carry a lot of resentments in our lives, because in growing up and through life, there's a lot to resent, you know, from parents and from teachers and from disappointed with friends or partners or whatnot. And so we carry a lot of resentment, and then we you know, then the idea we should be able to forgive, and then so sometimes we, you know, we say we've forgiven them, but we've not really maybe addressed our, you know, maybe the resentment we feel. So in metta practice, it's always, I found, you know, just trying to forgive everybody that's done me wrong, and trying to, you know, I like the idea of it, but on emotional level, intellectually I can do it, but emotionally, something else. And the more somebody has harmed you or abused you or disappointed you or persecuted you, then it gets more difficult, you know, on the emotional level. So that's where it's mindfulness is being able to have metta for your own resentments, which means like allowing yourself to have these feelings in a kind of metta style and just accepting it. Like metta's not approving or judging, it's just not criticizing, not telling you that you shouldn't feel like this or that you should forgive and forget, the past doesn't matter, but just get on with life, forgive your enemies, and that's what your intellect will say. And that's what probably other people will tell you to do. But in terms of your own direct experience, when certain things on emotional level, we haven't been able to really accept our own pain or resentment. So that's where I found helpful for me was, rather than try to convince myself I've forgiven everybody, I've really learned to accept the fact that I haven't forgiven and I'm angry and resentful about things of the past. And by this, then I can actually, you know, I'm allowing it to be fully conscious in the sense of metta, non-critical, non-judgmental way. And then from that, then more and more the suppressed resentments and angers drop away because you're consciously kind of letting them go. And then you can think of somebody who really did you wrong in the past. And if you do it this way, then eventually, as you really let go of your resentments, which is not suppressing, but allowing yourself to resent things, but not grasping it. That's metta. That can be seen also as a metta practice. Then these things naturally, if you accept them, don't attach to them or resist them, then they naturally go. It's resolving those karmic tendencies. Then you find, you think of the person that did you wrong and you've forgiven them. But it's not just that ideal of that you should do it, but it's actually, you know, you're not carrying anything, you're not suppressing anything, you're not blaming or wallowing in it or feeling guilty about yourself not being able to forgive. So it's a, I remember a couple of years ago there was an Anglican priest, a woman in England whose daughter was murdered, I think in this bombing on the London Underground, and she had a parish, and but she could never forgive the people that set the bombs off and killed her daughter, So she resigned from her parish. She felt she couldn't be a proper priest because she's teaching forgiveness, but she can't do it herself. And this was publicized a lot in the English newspaper, the British newspapers. And then I heard her interviewed on Radio 4, and, you know, she didn't know how to resolve that, you know, like, you know, she's seeing herself as an Anglican priest that should be able to forgive, teaching everybody else, but she can't do it. And this is why, you know, I really started contemplating what to do, you know, like if, like she, you know, the hurt, the anger, the resentment of her daughter, I think it was her only child, being killed. And then, she was a young woman. And then her own position of being, trying to be this priest that can do everything right. And so it's too, you know, I can see she's holding on to too many ideals. And then this way of forgiving yourself, you know, like the actual formulaic metta practices, may I abide in well-being and so forth. You're always starting with here rather than out there. And so, you know, like people do feel, you know, carry resentments and then feel guilty about it, or they just hold on, you know, it's just wallow in their resentment and let it make them embittered and resentful about their lives. So this is how I found, one time in giving a, there was, I wasn't giving this retreat, there was a monk giving a retreat, a metta retreat at Amaravati, and then a woman on the retreat got very upset and came to me and said, you know, she, you know, he has this practice where he spreads metta to yourself, and then they start mentioning parents. And every time he said, now spread metta to your mother, she just felt angry. And so she obviously had a problem with her mother. So so then she felt terrible, like she couldn't stay in the retreat because, you know, she just felt incredibly angry whenever this monk said, now spread metta to your mother. And it just triggered off this incredible rage. She had to leave. And then she felt guilty about it, because you're supposed to forgive, you know, love your mother and things like this, according to the, you know, the ideals of the society. And you're born out of your mother, you should be able to spread metta to her. It's all full of shoulds and ideas. But this particular concept of mother brought this rage. Then this woman felt guilty that she was something wrong with her. So I kind of encouraged her to forgive herself first, you know, to be able to accept this rage, not feel that she's bad because she hates her mother, but and when she should spread metta to her, but to consciously, mindfully accept her own rage and hatred without attaching to it or resist or suppressing it. I don't know how successful she was, but I found it works for me. Because I can't, you know, I can't just fool myself and may all, you know, people that have offended and hurt and I resent, just convince myself that I forgive, that I can do it, you know, you know, say the words. But on the heart level, what are you really feeling? What's really going on? And this is where the mindfulness embraces both, you know, the ideal and the reality of your own emotional reaction in the present, like this. Then after a while, it there's no problem. You can have metta for, say, your mother, who you maybe feel angry with or whatever. But before you can actually do that emotionally, you have to find more equanimity and not just trying to suppress your feelings and act like you, like a good Anglican priest should do, you know, and pretend that you've forgiven all those terrorists that bombed the London Underground. At least the priest, she was honest about it, you know, she had integrity, but I felt rather sad because obviously she was a good person, you know. She just didn't know how to resolve that, didn't know how to do it. Like the, you can see like all the problems in the, like with the Israelis and Palestinians, and you know, they just create more anger and hatred and resentment with each other. They're not resolving the problems on either side. Blame, and then they do terrible things, kill each other, and create more resentment, anger, and bitterness. And so it's hopeless. You know, how can you kind of, you know, if you keep bombing each other, killing each other, terrorizing each other, you're just feeding this, you know. You can't suddenly say, well, we forgive each other and we'll live in peace forevermore. Because the actual problem's never been resolved, never really admitted or recognized or resolved. And that's why, you know, like all these things in, like in the Balkans, you know, that when Tito was alive and he could hold Yugoslavia together, and then when he died, you know, suddenly it all broke up into Vipaka Kama, ethnic resentments from way back between the Croats and the Serbs and the Muslims, and terrible slaughter and butchering that went on amongst people that had been united as Yugoslavia, but it was like a surface, you know, it held together kind of through a strong man, and then when he was gone, there's nothing to hold it together, so all these old resentments dating back to the Ottoman Empire and whatnot, the Turks and the Muslims, and then the Serbs and the Croats from the Second World War. You know, the Croats were with Germany, and the Serbs were brutalized by the Nazis. And so there's, even though they're ethnically the same people, they're culturally, one's Roman Catholic and the other's Orthodox. So there's resentments over just from Second World War, from and I don't know all the intricate details of the Balkans, you know, between the Bosnians and the Kosovo and Macedonia, Albania. But you know, like there's always these ethnic conflicts and hatreds going on, and unresolved, but merely suppressed, maybe. like anti-Semitism, you know, that's never really been resolved, you know, so it's maybe suppressed. Ideally, none of us, you know, ideally it's not politically correct to be anti-Semitic, but has it really been resolved, the problem of, you know, Christianity and Judaism? And so it could break out again, you know, when its political correctness changes to something else. That's why it's a ignorance is the cause of suffering. You know, and these ethnic identities, you know, one can feel anger about things that happened 500 years ago that have nothing to do with my life in the present. Just through some ethnic prejudice that you grow up with, that are part of your cultural conditioning. So it's a, you know, it's a real challenge, you know, to, you know, that this is where this particular path of the Buddha does give you that perspective on emotional conditioning. I don't see how you could really have it very clearly in any other way. Because even religions tend to promote division, you know, like Theravada and Mahayana and things like this. We can carry these around. You know, we're all Buddhists, but we're the original, we're the pure form, and you're not as pure as we are. You know, it happens on the conditioned level. It's just the way things. The conditioned level is the realm of ignorance, and as long as that's all we see and know and observe and attach to, then it's just an endless kind of vortex of changing conditions and vipaka karma that motivates us to commit atrocities or seek revenge. Annihilate. But with the path of the Buddha, it's a path of wisdom where one can see, you know, in my own life, just observing the resentments of my life. Some are just kind of neurotic things, but other things they're justified. I can justify, you know. I wasn't always treated fairly, and you know, I wasn't always respected in the proper way and treated fairly by everybody. And so, even though my life, I've never, you know, I don't have any great, you know, I've never been terribly mistreated or abused. I've had enough of the other to feel resentful about it. And then in this way of practice, I've been able to see the suffering by either suppressing it from becoming, trying to be the good bhikkhu that has loving kindness for all beings, and then not being really able to feel that way. You know, then feeling like a hypocrite, like you're not a very good bhikkhu because you should have compassion and you don't, to where you actually, you know, letting your lack of compassion into consciousness rather than making it into personal fault and guilt, cause for guilt. And in this way, then more and more you find your strength within yourself in a universal, unconditioned reality in Dhamma rather than in cultural biases or political correctness or trying to live up to ideals that you have of how you should be. This is very important, actually. This is where we suffer, you know, from so much of our anguish is around, so, you know, these kind of things, that we, even if we haven't had, you know, been caught in like a Holocaust or anything horrible, but in anyone's life there's enough of to resent. That's why I'm quite grateful that having been able to work through the kind of, I haven't had big problems, you know, like really. I've never been, you know, really mistreated or abused in any big way. But also I found the real challenges were just learning the little things that one tends to dismiss, you know, like intellectually, I think, oh, forget it, you know, that happened long ago, it doesn't mean anything. Don't make a scene. Don't be so stupid, you know, just stiff upper lip, carry on, get on with life. And, you know, so that's one way of dealing with it. But that also, you pay the price of not resolving it. And then it'll come up later in your life in some other way.
Ascribing meaning to things and then not really noticing the consequences of doing that. So I'm just thinking when you were saying how small things might annoy me and I might just brush them off, but I've noticed sometimes that if I don't attend to that, these things, this irritation just can sit with me. And, you know, sometimes later I might think, just have a general mood of irritation. I wonder where that came from. And if I look carefully, sometimes I can see that it's just been just brushing off little things, you know, built up type of thing. So there isn't an obvious irritation. It's just allowing that irritation to continue.
Right. It'll, you know, like this itta-bhujjata, this things arise because of conditions. And so I found this is a good reflection because you know, like from the Western way of thinking, I had this idea that I had these neurotic problems that I kept within me, you know, that I, you know, deep down inside there were all kind of latent energies and things like this. And I remember when I first started taking an interest in psychology, I was actually frightened of it because I thought I might find out things I didn't really want to know because I could imagine all kinds of dark, horrible things that I'm not having, you know, that because I had a lot of fear, and I thought I'd rather not know about these or face them. But also there was something, you know, interest in it, you know. And then in my life, you know, I've found that in monastic life I've been able to work it all out through through circumstance, so that when conditions arise, like even though you might think you're bypassing life by becoming a samana or something, it actually, you know, it really makes you face things in a way that if I were a layperson, I wouldn't have to. I'd have too many easy distractions. And where in monastic life, you're kind of stuck with yourself so much of the time. And not, you know, so you, then that's really good. Like that first year when I was a samanera, living with myself alone was horrible at first. Just 3 months of just repressed anger, almost seeming nonstop. And that wasn't due to any conditions there, you know, like the people in the monastery. But it was just 31 years of repressing anger. And then I didn't have any distractions to just, you know, in a lay life, I'd found ways of, you could smoke a cigarette, have a drink, watch the television, call your friend on the phone, read a book, and whatever. But in the monastic life, in this little hut, and nobody can speak English, and you're just faced with, and there's nothing to do day or night. So you know, I tried the samatha practice. I wanted to get the jhanas very much because I wanted to get myself into this blissful state and hopefully stay there. And so then I put a lot of effort into that, but then the 31 years of repressed anger, I couldn't suppress anymore, and I couldn't just suppress it with jhanas. So it's just started erupting, and fortunately, you know, it wasn't due to anybody in the monastery or the, but I was alone, so I didn't say anything to anyone or hit anyone. So I was in a safe place, so I could actually, you know, let it come up, and something intuitively I knew that I should just observe it, because there's nothing else to do. You know, I tried everything else to try to get rid of it, but it couldn't do it. And then and the conditions then for, you know, all the distracting habits of 30 years weren't there for me. So I could see back in my life this tendency to, when I start feeling ill at ease, or there's always some way to distract myself, get away from it, and run away from things that I found too difficult, and any time there's any, this started to reach consciousness, you just, not even intentionally, you just automatically kind of have ways of getting rid of it or ignoring it. And then I'm alone in a little hut in a strange country, you know, it was like living in hell for about 3 months. But then the wonderful thing was, about after 3 months, I woke up one morning and there was nothing, no anger at all. And I even tried to revive it, thinking of all the things that I couldn't do it. Nothing would get me angry. And I was in this state of, like everything was luminous. And it wasn't a very beautiful forest. It was kind of scrubby trees, and the kuti was very basic, kind of boards nailed to posts and things like this. But it looked like a palace. It was luminous. And then the bathroom, the toilet, was just a grotty little place. It looked gorgeous. And it was, and I thought, oh, you're enlightened. And then, you know, so then also it was so beautiful, and it's like, you know, it's like cleaning a dirty window. Like you have a window in your house, your apartment, and it gets all clouded up with grime, and you just get used to looking through the grime. You know, you adjust yourself, so everything begins to look grimy. And then, you know, so before I think, why is life so grimy and it's all gray and dreary? And then this was like washing the window. It's like, oh, yes. Cleaning the window, and then you get this clear view, beautiful colors and whatnot, light and so forth. So it was... And that lasted for quite a few days, that kind of blissful state. But then things started happening where I'd be thrown back into states. But I did, you know, I did have an experience of a pure consciousness without negativity for the first time probably since I was a child, a very small child. And because, you know, your children, I remember having a kind of, you know, happy childhood in the early part before starting school. I remember it being quite magical and pleasant. And then going to school was a trauma. and that's where I remember starting to experience suffering that I can remember was engaging in school with teachers and other children. And then you grow up and you learn how to survive in situations, you know, with your family, with the school, with the society you're in, and how to get through and get by with things. And you just... But it's all based not on wisdom, but on survival and habit formations, habit patterns that you develop from maybe very early childhood that some people can carry through their whole lives. If you ever work with old people, you know, sometimes they get very childish and, you know, people that were once seemingly the, you know, very mature adults suddenly go very childish, throw tantrums and stomp their feet when they don't get their own way, just like you do when you're 3 years old. So you think, you know, then you learn, you know, when you throw tantrums and you realize that that doesn't work, you suppress the desire, then maybe it comes out when you're 80. So, so you know, we our personalities are formed through surviving and through praise and blame and success and failure. And so then, it doesn't help us at the end of our lives because we've usually formed our characters formed early in our life. So in like in this Itabajjata teaching, when the conditions for, like, not getting my own way, for example, say when I was little, you know, I'd throw a tantrum if I didn't get my own way, and then I realized that didn't really work. But then later on, you know, as I became more aware, I realized when I couldn't get my own way, I felt like throwing a tantrum, but I didn't, because, you know, so the emotion, it was suppressed, the actual feeling was denied, but not out of wisdom or understanding suffering, but just so you didn't look bad in front of others, to be socially acceptable. And, because that's what you learn when you're a child, that people don't like you when you're throwing tantrums. So, but maybe you've never resolved it. So in monastic life, you know, you become more willing to look at that in yourself. When the conditions arise where I don't get my own way, this feeling. And then by making it, allowing it to be conscious, then you're actually letting go of the feeling. And it goes through like conscious, you're consciously aware it is what it is. You're not saying it's mine or about how it should or shouldn't be. It's just it's like this. And then it naturally ceases. So that's like resolving your karmic tendencies with your emotional habits that were formed when you were very young. This is like an emphasis now in psychotherapy on mindfulness practices. Finally realizing that is the way to deal with emotional problems. You know, not through drugs or through endless talking about, you know, analyzing yourself, but through mindfulness practices. Because it does, and it's just on a psychotherapeutic level it works.
I wanted to ask about the physical sensations when I meditate, which feel to me that as if these are repressed emotions, that they something's stuck, but they don't speak.
What I would do is just be aware of them. Don't, you know, just let them be what they are, but kind of embrace them, let them be this way, and notice any tendencies you have of wanting to do something with it. Just to trust yourself more, just to accept it the way it is. Because then there's also, it creates a desire to get rid of it or to see it as something that you've got to do something about. And it's easy to think that you shouldn't have these kind of things or that there's some kind of sign of something wrong with you, where it's just, they are what they are in the present. You know, that's an honest reflection. You're not trying to pretend it's something else. But also you're not adding anything onto it, like judging it or claiming it as your personal problem or trying to figure out why. But it is, the conditions for this particular physical feeling are present at this time, it's like this. And trusting that awareness is what I recommend.
I find that every time I sit to meditate, it's very different, and I adjust my practice based on how I assess the conditions of my mind in the present moment. So if I sit and I'm agitated, then I'll watch the agitation and probably use the breath, because I think it's better not to be agitated. I like to find the calmness behind the agitation. Other times when I sit and I'm not so agitated, I'll just sit in the spaciousness until I get lost, and then I'll find my way back to the breath. But I don't have a, you know, someone would say, what do you do when you meditate? My answer is variations on theme, but different every time. And I've never asked a teacher whether that's a good thing or not, or whether I should, you know, do a breath practice, do a mindfulness vipassana practice, or apply more concentration. I think I've experienced enough now, maybe, that I can make that assessment and then apply a practice based on my assessment.
Well, it's, you know, what you're saying is very, is using mindfulness. That's very good, actually, to do that. Because sometimes, you know, you get, you'll get, somebody will say you should be doing this and doing that. But this is, you know, like if you are agitated, then, you know, and then you're sitting, say you're doing formal sitting practice and you feel excited, agitated, stressed, to try to get rid of it is coming out of ignorance and self, you know, wanting, not wanting it to be like this. Or somebody told you you should practice anapanasati to get rid of it, or you should, you know, so then you lack your own confidence, so you think the teacher knows, so you try to do what somebody tells you to do. But this is more intuitive, where you actually recognize that you know you need. If you're excited or stressed, then just sit there and let it be this way, and kind of patient acceptance of it. Then actually the conditions for stress are, you're not creating more conditions to be feel stressed with. You're more sort of just accepting, relaxing, letting it be. And then you're not creating, adding to the stress through trying to get rid of it or do something about it. And that's intuitive, intuition. And, but it's common sense, too. You know, it's like, you know, if you have muddy water and just trying to pick out all the mud in the water, you keep stirring it up. If you just set it down for a while and the mud sinks to the bottom. And so this is intuitive wisdom. Then you will feel inclined towards, you know, as you calm down, then you're more, you have, things will, maybe certain conditions arise. Maybe you're facing personal problems or difficulties that bother you. And so they'll start coming up into, and, or sometimes, or other times there's just nothing. One goes to just anapanasati or using the body as a focus of observing the feelings in the body, the vedana of the body. But it and then also this also is good preparation for reflecting on the Four Noble Truths, for investigating Dhamma. You know, when you have more calm to have that perspective on it. But this is where it's always good to know how you are feeling at the present time. Because, you know, like one woman I remember in London, she's a kind of professional person who I'd known for a long time, and she'd been practicing meditation before I even went to England. So she was kind of an old timer and meditating. And so one day she came to me and she said she's so frustrated because, you know, all these years she'd practiced anapanasati and it didn't work. And she goes home and she tries to sit down and be calm, and she gets caught up with things and she can't meditate. And so I asked her, I said, what is it? What kind of work do you do? And so she said, she has to use the telephone a lot. She's talking to people all day, and it'd be kind of busy, stressful job she had. And then she goes home, and then she feels she should meditate, and then she can't. Then she feels stressed out by her work, and then she can't meditate, and she feels despair. It's a vicious circle. So I said, look, you, this idea of doing anapanasati, I said, forget it. You know, when you go home, you know, and you're alone in your flat, observe, you know, if you feel stressed and being kind of wound up and if you're living a busy life talking to people all day, you can't just, you know, go inside your flat and suddenly drop into a state of calm. You've got all this energy and physical energy and all, you know, spending hours in the day talking to people and dealing with problems. So see meditation like Lungpo Cha's definition of holiday for the heart, the kind of like a holiday rather than something you've got to do and cultivate. So sometimes we can become obsessive, compulsive around meditation, when actually it's holiday for the heart. And then you trust yourself to observe what, you know, there'll be signs where you're more clear about ways of dealing with things or calming or whatever, but it'll come not through me telling you, but through your own recognition of the way things are as you're experiencing them. Because I don't, you know, you have to live with yourself all the time. You know, I've just met you. Oh.